Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com, the official page for travel to the Napa Valley, America's legendary wine, food, arts, and wellness capital. For more information, visit www.visitnapavalley.com.
I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and this is coming to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Heritage Radio Network and In the Drink airs live at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays. From here in Bushwick at Roberta's. And when I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at one of our restaurants. I'm the beverage director of Dell'Anima, Lartuzzi, Lapicho, and Anfora in New York City's kind of downtown area of Manhattan. I'm excited today. We have several guests on the show today, and the topic is going to be the recent invasion of California with Italian grape varieties. There was a time when in California there were many, many different grapes that were grown. There was no sort of clear favorite as to what was the first, but through a different variety of forces, partially it being the Judgment of Paris tasting in 1976 when Cabernet and Chardonnay won both of those, and then certainly forces of several journalists really falling in love with these grapes. The variety of Italian grapes in California decreased over years, and the variety of grapes from all over the world decreased to the point where it was really just Pinot Noir, and really Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon predominantly, maybe secondary Pinot Noir and Merlot and some Sauvignon Blanc. But what's really exciting that's going on now is that growers are embracing grapes from all over the world. And today we have two producers here who are really embracing Italian grapes. We have Ryan and Megan Glab from Glab. Damn it, I did this right before the show. Glab. They're not globby, they're glad. They're Glab from Rhyme. I love these wines. We have them at Lapicho. They're working with coastal Italian grapes. I was thinking about this on the way over, that you guys have Fiano and Aglianico from the Campania coast, Vermentino, which you see on the coast of certainly Tuscany and Liguria, and then a little bit of Ribolla, which is on the coast of Friuli, maybe a little bit further inland. And then we have Sam Bilbro from Idlewild, who's working predominantly with Piemontese grapes. So very exciting to have you guys here. Thank you so much for coming to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Sorry for that extra long introduction. can you tell us just get a quick rundown of how you guys started? I kind of think of the producers that are doing really exciting things in California as falling into one of three categories. Either they're the producers who have always been making more elegant and balanced, food-friendly wines, and they never change it. They've been around for a while, and that's a very small amount. Producers who are making kind of bigger, more full-bodied, oakier alcoholic wines, and then have scaled things back as tastes have changed. And then new producers who've got into it and are making these really delicious, food-friendly, interesting wines. And I think all you guys would fall into that third category.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for us, it was just about making wines that we were excited about. Not necessarily out there to make Italian varieties, but that's what we're drawn to and what we love. You know, for us, wine's about sitting down and eating and drinking with your friends and making wines that suit that.
I'd agree with that. I started on the actually more on the sales side and was slowly but surely disenchanted with everything about that. And when thinking about producing wine, it was well, this stuff sells, but I don't like this stuff. Mm. Why do I want to do this? And that was the desire for so long, was to get into production, and it never set in, and I never did it until I finally said, well, screw it. I'm just going to make what I like and love, and I'll probably never go anywhere, but I'll be happy doing it.
And Sam, when you first got into it, what were the wines that you were interested in and that you loved? And why did you think, I mean, wine is an agricultural product, and I really love, you know, some obscure Jura grapes. And certainly there are, like, Trousseau is kind of having a moment in California. But how did you know that these grapes would do well in California, and how did you match the site to that?
Sure. Once you decide you're going to do something like this, then you, I mean, start Googling everything you can. You start looking at crush reports. You start researching every little detail, because you're never going to have the same overlaps, but how can you find some overlaps? And so you start at least drawing some connection to the origins. I mean, simple stuff like, I don't want to go down to Paso Robles, but if you want, you know, limestone or at least calcareous-based soils, that's where you go, but that's not where I was going to go. So, okay, well, what else is in Piedmont besides that? Oh, there's a lot of sandstone. Well, and we can find that. So you start finding your overlaps and then digging in. And
going for you, was it more of a function of finding similar soils where you knew that those grapes would do well, or was it more about the climate, the amount of hours of sunlight or rain?
Both. I think at least a commonality in both areas. I work predominantly out of Mendocino County for the Piedmont varietals, and at first it didn't seem like it would work, but then you start looking into more of the specific details. So this vineyard that I work from is basically a north-facing slope in a warm area. So I don't have the Alps sending down cool air, but I have a north-facing slope kind of mitigating the direct heat, and that's the same kind of the same end result gotten to from a very different way, but in the end we're not there, so why should we pretend we're there? We should be finding something similar where we are.
Now, Ryan, and I just found this out yesterday. I know I'm probably super late to the game, but the name Ryan is combination of Ryan and Megan. I'm sorry, the name Ryan is a combination of Ryan and Megan, so you have they're a married couple, and it's half and half. So I said your winery is relatively new, started in 2007, but you guys aren't new to the game. You've both worked at wineries really all around the world. Can you tell us about how your past experience has influenced what you're doing? And it seems that the wines that you're making, especially the skin macerated Ribolla and Vermentino, are kind of a departure from wines you've made in the past.
Yeah, we, Megan and I met working together in Australia. So like you said, we've both worked around the industry for the last 15 years or so in different facets. Met working together in Australia, really share a similar passion in wines. Always been drawn to Italian wines, Italian food and culture, just a dynamic, kind of diverse culture of Italy. We've just it's always been a very special thing for us. And so when we started making wines, we started with Alianico in 2007, more of a experimental small project. Some friends of ours farming the vineyard down south in Paso Robles, and our wines kind of grew organically from there, never having, at least not starting out with a real solid master plan, but we're slowly finding little pockets, different varieties. California is such a diverse climate and geology that there's tons of room for experimentation.
For everyone here, how important is it for you to find growers who are currently working with these grapes, and then working with them to source fruit? And are you also planting some grapes yourselves?
Both. I mean, I think you start with what's in the ground, because, I mean, the simple math of time and money, and, you know, to make it happen, to plant a vineyard and to do it on something that isn't tested yet, it's hard to kind of get over that initial nugget. But if you can find a spot that feels right, start there. But then I think all of us long term have hopes of seeing our own plantings in the ground, with as we drill down further into what's actually working and why these work wherever they work.
Sam, can you kind of talk us through the difference between how long it would take and how much it would kind of cost to plant a vineyard from scratch versus grafting over from some vines that are already there versus buying grapes or working with a grower who's already producing? How do you make the decision to do one of those three things?
Sure. Well, just the difference between the three. If you go to someone who's already growing grapes and it's an established vineyard and you can get the fruit, that's year one. You're buying it. You're making it. Depending on what it is, that's however long before you can release it. If you're going to graft, you have a minimum of 1 year before that's going to turn into a viable fruit, before you can then pick. But really, I would look at it as 2 years. If you're planting, you probably have a year of development. You have 3 years before you're going to be able to pick fruit, probably 5 years before you're going to get the fruit you really want. It's just a simple game of time.
I think the biggest thing for all of us is, young in California, land is incredibly expensive. Actually going in there, owning your own, putting in the vines is just not a viable thing for us newbies. And, for Rhyme, we have been lucky in that when we're looking at grape growing reports and finding these varieties that we're really excited about, the biggest thing is making sure it's in a spot that is conducive to that variety. And we have been able to find those plantings. And what's really exciting is having these growers who've put it in and are behind it, even though they could get more money for a different variety in that spot. So, for example, George Bear, Cabernet in the Okanol district of Napa Valley could command, $8,000 a ton. Instead, he has Ribolo Gialla. So these are all passion projects, which is, I think, really exciting.
And I can second that, too, with Fox Hill, where I get all the Piedmontese varietals. It's not the same economics as a Napa by any means, but selling a wide spectrum of Italian varietals out of Mendocino doesn't make, economically or, any of that much sense. But Lowell loved it. Lowell went to Italy and on a random whim, because he was actually going to Finland to find his family roots, and ended up in Italy instead and came back with cuttings and said, I like this and I want to do it. Wow. That's special, just like what George Bear did.
And Megan, I know that you knew George Vare personally. I don't know if you can kind of talk about the influence that he had. I've spoken with Abe Schoner, and he talks from the Scullion Project very affectionately about how George brought him on a trip to Friuli and was just a great proponent of Italian grapes in California. But if you have an anecdote about George you'd like to share, I'd love to hear it.
No, I think anybody who knew George, automatically fell in love with him. He's just a really, really great guy and really kind. And, I think the Vare project has been really special. There's seven of us producers making the Ribolo from there. And, again, he could have been putting in Cabernet or something else, and instead he went over to Friuli and brought back cuttings from Grafner and put it in. And it's exciting to see his legacy continue. And now Steve Mathiasen is farming it and we'll continue it.
Oh, that's great to hear that it's in good hands, good stewardship. We're actually going to take a very quick break, but we'll be back more with the producers who are making some of the best Italian grape varieties in California right after this short break.
This one's called Kill Me in the Summertime by the Dead Stars. This is In the Drink.
Program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com. Welcome to the Napa Valley, North America's legendary wine and food capital, where the art of living well is defined and each season holds a story waiting to be discovered. Life feels slower here, lived at a place where tables are set with care. Fine wine and food are created from the bounty of our own vineyards and gardens, and relationships with friends and family gathered around the table are somehow sweeter. When planning a trip to the Napa Valley, we invite you to visit the destination's official visitor website, visitnapavalley.com, or stop by Napa County's official visitor information center, located in downtown Napa, where our friendly and knowledgeable community ambassadors can assist you in creating your own legendary Napa Valley experiences. The Visitor Information Center is located at 600 Main Street in Napa and is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., 7 days a week, 360 days a year. Your invitation to experience the Napa Valley beckons. Take a deep breath, lose yourself in our quiet green and golden hills, renew your body and spirit, taste our legendary wines and cuisine, and experience the people who make this valley like no other in the world. For more information, go to visitnapavalley.com.
All right, we're back with Rhyme Vineyard and Idlewild making some really, truly beautiful Italian grape varieties in California. Ryan, can you tell us about the two Vermentinos that you make? I think this is such an interesting project that you guys work on. There have been countless guests that we've served the his and hers Vermentinos to, and I'll tell you, our guests really love it. I love the wines. But how did that come about?
Thank you. We love Vermentino. It's such a, can be a beautiful, delicate, aromatic, just incredibly fun to drink wine. Does really well in California climate, and I think there's a lot of people talking about planting more and more Vermentino in California right now. I guess the real inspiration, I think, to me at least, for making Vermentino at all was a wine called Massavecchia in Tuscany. Just an incredibly crazy, beguiling orange wine from coastal Tuscany. And in 2009, we started with Ribolla Gialla. We're both just crazy orange wines fans. The wines are, they go so well with so many foods. Really versatile, can be. And as a kind of a counterpoint to the Ribolla Gialla, Vermentino is kind of the opposite spectrum of orange wine. It's so, so exuberant and fun and, juicy. So that was kind of the idea, and found this vineyard, beautiful white wine site in Carneros, and kind of right before harvest, we realized that Meg and I had completely divergent views on what we envisioned that wine to be. So we had to compromise.
And it was like in a working marriage, you know, we're two winemakers is like, you know, two chefs in a kitchen, and we work extremely well together. And this was the first time we disagreed on how we wanted to approach a wine. And there's no middle ground, you know, it was either one way or the other. And for sake of winery, marriage, and continuing together, we decided to have our own. And they're really, you know, they're standalone wines. They have different places. You know, the Hers is really great, bright, fresh, and good on its own on a hot day, where the skim fermented Vermentino is, you know, much more cerebral. I think it commands food and, you know, they're fun. The fruit comes in on the same day, and it's nice to see the same fruit, you know, treated differently. And I think we have found that our customers really enjoy those two wines, particularly because they're, you know, a different style with the exact same fruit.
Yeah. So the fruit, it's treated the same all year long, and then it comes into the winery. And for the Hers, you include some stems. And no skin, is that in the his, we have skin but no stems, is that accurate?
Well, so the Hers is more of a traditional white wine. So in white production, the fruit comes in, you press it off. So you press the juice straight off the skins. And then the Hers is fermented in a combination of stainless steel and neutral barrel. So fermentation, no skins, no stems. The his is treated like a red wine. So whole cluster, stems included, and then fermented to dryness on the skins.
So the his would qualify as something that you might call an orange wine. But what I really love about it is that it's not a polarizing orange wine. It's a complete wine that is complex, has great texture, great minerality, and I think that it's a good one too. It's an orange wine that I introduce people to the category with, but not as this is lesser orange. So I was like, but this is what orange wine can be for the future. It's approachable and it's a beautiful, really complete wine. And I think that anyone who makes the argument that inclusion of skins on white wine somehow detracts from the wine, I would show them your wine in a heartbeat to counter that that argument.
Awesome, that's great. I mean, the things we value in wine is the same, whether it's white, red, or orange. We both love wines with a lot of purity, a lot of energy, you know, plenty of fruit, but tension as well. So it's just a matter of you make a clean orange wine the same way you make a clean red wine, you know.
Oh. And Sam, tell us a little bit about the 7% project I was reading that you're a part of.
Sure. There's two ways to talk about this. I'll introduce 7% as a general theme first and kind of tell where it came from. 7% is a group of us who all kind of got together to sort of celebrate what's happening in California. And the theme that we were able to tie it around was the less common varieties that are now being made and sought out, and kind of all banded together to just put on tasting. It was actually meant to be a celebration more than anything else, and kind of we're taken aback. We planned the first event 2 years ago now, and we had 1 month to throw it, and it was talked about everywhere, and we were like, whoa, we were just having fun with friends. 7% is a reference to, at the time when we first started, this has now changed, which is, I think, a great testament to it actually working, but 7% was 7% of varieties in the North Coast were anything but the 8 most common varieties. Does that make sense? So, you know, there's thousands of varieties in this world, and 93% of what was planted in the North Coast of California was 8 varieties. That's crazy. Doesn't make any sense if you think about how young California is as a region, and yet we're already focusing on 8 things. And then the other side of it is, it was simply, I wanted to taste all these wines and hang out with these people who I liked and get to enjoy that day. So kind of threw it together.
Great. And do you organize taste? What is the ongoing functionality of this group? Is this just a loose group of friends who kind of share wines, or do you, like, is there something more to it?
It's definitely an ongoing tasting. We'll be throwing them once a year, one in Hillsburg always. Then we added San Francisco last year. We will, hopefully the intention is to get to New York as well, but when is the question? Maybe next year is the hope. But part of what we all want is it to stay very, very informal, very grassroots, very low key. It's not, I think that celebratory factor is, what made it a special tasting.
I'm going to throw this question out to the group. How do you guys all feel about the term Cal-a-tal? Does this make you cringe, or is it a fun marketing term that maybe gets people into the wines?
I think definitely cringeworthy. There was a little bit of fiasco in the 90s with Napa Valley and Sangiovese. Some beautiful wines, actually. And George Vera owned Luna Vineyards, as a matter of fact. They still make a nice, really nice Sangiovese. I think people had different aspirations. I mean, the Super Tuscan thing was really popular, and I think eventually people just decided, like, why do we have Sangiovese that tastes like Cabernet? We should just keep making Cabernet. And so I think Italian varieties in California, they still get kind of stigmatized in a way in people's minds, and for some reason that Cal-a-tal thing is like the moniker used.
Yeah, one of the things that I really appreciate about all of your wines is that they don't taste exactly like the Italian equivalent. There's an interpretation that is distinctly California, distinctly from where you're coming from. And I think that is great, because if they tasted just like the Italian version, it would be, why don't you just drink the Italian version? But the wines are unique. Is that something that you're distinctly, that you're going for? Are you trying to emulate the Italian regions?
They're purely California wines. I mean, you can't help but compare them to what, you know, whatever a Alianico benchmark is, or but we love California. California makes amazing wines. We have incredible climate and soils and people in the wine industry.
And that being said, I'd love to taste your Fiano that you brought with us. This is really exciting for me. I don't think I've ever had a California Fiano before tasting yours. Where did you find these grapes, and how did this come about?
For me, Fiano has been an obsession. I really love it. And Fiano, I think it makes an exciting, age-worthy white as well. Great phenolics, great structure. And so we had been looking for some Fiano, and I had a friend call and say, you want to come look at a vineyard that has Fiano planted? And I said, yes, where is it? And she said, it's up, you know, at the top of Dry Creek Valley. So it was pretty close to home. And I think the area is perfect for Fiano, which is a sun-loving variety. And I think that's a big key factor here, is a lot of these varieties are well suited to our sunny disposition in California. So I went and had a look at the vineyard and literally stepped out of the car and was like, we're taking it. I love this. It's amazing. And, you know, the vineyard owner, he's like, oh, I got to give you the caveats. You know, we're lucky to get it to 23 bricks in October. Check, done. Love it. and then he's like, yeah, and it kind of gets a little bit golden in color. It's a little bit funny how it does that. And I was like, oh, this is, you know, you're singing my song. So he was actually going to graft it over the following year. And we convinced him not to, and we're really thrilled and excited with the end result. Yeah.
So when tasting the Lago Vineyard Fiano, how do you separate what are some of the grape characteristics and what are the vineyard characteristics, particularly in this wine? If you were to plant Chardonnay or another grape here, what would stick out that is particular to this vineyard, and what's just from the Fiano?
That's a good question. There is a kind of a sunny warmth to the wine, you know. However, I think what's really great about Fiano, again, you know, we're picking this later in the harvest, and it's only 20.8 bricks. Where if there was another variety, Pinot Noir or even Chardonnay, I think it would fall apart there.
Yeah, and you know what? What's reminiscent of other Fianos that I really love is just the ripeness that you get on the nose, the weight on the palate, but with a wine that is low in alcohol and has really bright acidity and great minerality. That is, I imagine, very hard to get. And why I think that in those warmer climates, some of these Italian grapes are just so perfectly suited to it. I think this is a wine like this just fits the sensibility of how a lot of people are drinking now, right? This food friendly. My mouth is just watering. I can't even get a sentence out.
Thank you.
I couldn't agree more. That's what we love about Italian varieties in general, is they have such a powerful kind of acidic and structural quality to the wine. So these varieties that are normally grow in, you know, warmer regions, you know, Fiano from Campania, pretty similar to California, and a wine that retains so much of that acidity. And what I love about this wine, and I think the real hallmark of Fiano to me, is kind of that structural quality, the kind of resinous, smoky, really phenolic quality. Mm-hmm. And I think that really comes through in this wine. The fruit's a little more front-loaded the fruit's a little more intense early on, where I think a friend said it, commented on it. I thought it was really appropriate. Fianos from Campania can be so backwards early, and then they develop some texture early on. And this wine, it has all the texture to start. I think we'll just kind of stretch out over time.
I love the wine. That's all I know. I've been to several vineyards that make Fiano in Campania, and I think this is, you know, it's right up there with the best of them. It's truly a delicious wine, and with a super long, very mineral finish. I'm still tasting the wine, and my mouth is still watering. Just congratulations. That wine is awesome.
Thank you so much.
All right. So now we have the Idyllwild Barbera in our glass. I think you guys could hear, we actually are pouring wine. It's really happening. Tell us about the origin of this one.
So this is all Mendocino County fruit from one vineyard that I work with, tend pretty much by myself with a couple, a little bit of help along the way. Barbera is actually the one grape out of Piedmont that is available in California more widely, and it is also the one that I was least sure I wanted to do at first, but I ended up deciding, just looking at everything I make, I wanted one more wine to add in. I make Dolcetto and a Nebbiolo, and those are definitely leaned out to the lightest edge that I can make them. And there's something about having a chewier, denser, savory side of red as well that I felt like I lacked. And with the city that Barbera has, it's just freakishly high acid if you choose to let it stay there and not, you know, I've actually heard about people in California deacidifying their Barberas, which makes me go cringe. But, So I took that acid and I tried to then build as much substance into that acid as I could by keeping all the stems in and building a tannic structure and really pushing that spice level.
Yeah, and the tannic structure really sticks out to me on this, because when tasting Barbera, especially young Barbera, the grape itself doesn't have a lot of grape tannin in the skins. And usually the only way you get tannin in it is if someone's thrown it into like some heavily charred new French oak or something. And then you can pick that out on the nose. You're like, oh, this is going to be like an oaky, weirdly tannic Barbera. But you don't get the oaky character. And it's just a beautiful kind of ongoing long texture of a nice tannin in the front. And then, again, lots of acid in this wine too.
Yeah. It's actually, I think, speaking of oak, I think that speaks back to talking about Calatal before. And kind of all of what we're here doing in a way, but the problem with so many of these varieties has been using a ton of new oak, in my opinion. That's one thing that's very not Italian. And, you know, to have taken a wine like the Barbera and then put into a bunch of new oak, you would have basically lost the purity of why it's Barbera. And I think that's one big change that both of us two producers are doing. I think most people who are making Italian varieties now are seeing just this, maybe a better sense of holding on to a better sense of purpose behind the varietals.
And now we have in our glass the Nebbiolo. What is the purpose behind this varietal?
So Nebbiolo is, it's...
We have the 2012
Nebbiolo. Yeah, so this is the 2012 Nebbiolo. This is the first wine that I knew I'd make, and I also was so unsure about would this work in California, but that's kind of exactly why I wanted to do it. And I wanted to find that ethereal side to Nebbiolo, which is, I think, what I had never tasted in California. And so to do that, I just started with experimenting. This is three different pieces that then ended up being blended back to try to learn what works here, because we don't know what works here yet, and so we should be exploring as we go. And I, by happenstance, just liked how the three pieces work together in the end.
I mean, what do you mean by three pieces? Are they three different clones, three vineyard plots?
So it's three. It actually is three different clones, all suitcased in, unknown exactly, but there's one from the Maquette biotype, one from the Lompia biotype, and one suitcase that he Scrooge just calls Bra because it came from the town of Bra, and we don't even know what it is, which is pretty neat. And then when I made it, I did three different pieces, so I just didn't know what would work, because it's, again, as we talked about before, we're in California. We're not in Campania for their wines or Piedmont for my wines. So you got to respect the origins, but you also respect the origins of being in California as well. And so to do that, I felt like, well, let's do three different pieces and see what seems best. One was with stems and pressed a little early. One was pressed just at dryness, and one was extended maceration, which means basically leaving the wine on skins for an extended amount of time, for a few months. I feel like those three pieces actually show in the wine. There's different layers and they all come back together.
Yeah, it really gives just like your Barbera, just a lot of textural complexity to the wine that is just making me want to order a pizza from Roberta's so badly. The wine's delicious, and I think you've, I think that I found when I speak with other industry professionals about Nebbiolo in California, there are some really like charged up feelings about it, because people love Barolo so much, love Barbaresco so much, that when growing this grape, they're like, well, it's got to be, you know, as good as like really good Barolo. Otherwise, why even bother? I love this wine, and obviously this is a 2012 that you can drink you can drink it sooner. Have you come across any of that kind of like Nebbiolo back? I feel like people are protective over Nebbiolo.
It's, Nebbiolo especially.
Exactly. Yeah. And
more than the other grapes.
I think we had the same conversation until maybe 10 years ago about Pinot Noir.
Okay.
And people don't even bring up Burgundy anymore in California.
I'd agree with that. And I think that's actually, on one hand, you maybe want to shy from it because, oh, it won't work outside. It's the one grape that won't work outside of its, you know, origins. That actually leads me to say, why? Like, why not? Like, we haven't tried. We should be trying. And maybe you're correct. Maybe it won't work outside of Piedmont. Won't work in California, but we don't know that until we actually take a lot of attempts and explore.
Well, I think you're definitely proving that it has a place outside of Piedmont. That wine is absolutely delicious and a definitely unique taste on it. All right, so we're going to finish on the Rhyme Ionico. I guess the wine that started it off for both of you guys.
It is, yeah. So we got a phone call from a friend, as Ryan was saying, who had put in Alionico down in Paso Robles. Beautiful site in the Temple of Wayne Gap, on a thread of limestone down there. I think a perfect place for Alionico. It comes in, like 3.1, 3.2 pH, amazing acidity. Great structure. And so unbeknownst to us, we said, yeah, well, you know, we'll do 1 ton. We were starting Rhyme. And so in came the fruit. We thought, oh, we'll have fun. We'll play. And we were so excited by the fruit and the vineyard that we continued making it and thus began our project. We whole cluster ferment this. So 100% whole cluster fermentation. And then press two neutral barrels. We don't use any new oak in the winery, and age it for 3 years in barrel.
Wow! So tell us about the origins of using whole cluster with Ionico, because I know of only one other person who's doing this, and I think that a lot of people are afraid of using whole cluster, which means using all of the stems included in it, because Ionico by itself is a grape that has pretty massive tannins, or can have really big tannins, and adding the stems will add another type of tannin to it. What made you think to do this in the first place, and what are the results? What have you found that how it affects the wine?
I think with the big tannic wines like that, it's kind of assumed as a given that using stems would be bad, we leave the stems in most of our wines, actually. We've always been drawn to wines like that, the more savory side of wines. I've been working with Pax Mailey for 9 years, and at the time in 07, everything was whole cluster. So I was like, well, not too much of a stretch to do the Alionico whole cluster. And it brings a tremendous lift to the aromatics, an incredibly spicy wine. And then in terms of the kind of tactile qualities of those stems, they add, there's tannin in stems. It adds to the tannin and kind of broads, kind of pulls out the tannin of the wine rather, it's more of a complete kind of mouth-filling, structure to the wine, where grape tannin can be so front-loaded and, kind of sharp and grippy. This makes bigger, chewier tannins.
Yeah. Almost like when people, you've ever seen the people who can like walk on spikes, right? If there was just one spike or two, that would go right through their feet. But if there's a ton of them, it balances that. Mm-hmm. It balances it out, and it spreads it out. So when you have both the grape tannin and some stem tannin and everything together, it fills it all out and makes this really kind of uplifting and balanced, complete texture to the tannin.
I agree. That's a great way to put it.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to finish up because I want to leave on a high note. guys, thank you so much. It's been really a pleasure to have you. I mean, one of the things that I really love about your wines, other than the fact that they're truly delicious, is that you guys bring a curiosity to winemaking and create wines that are really they're unique and singular and make you think about wine while it's just fun and delicious to drink them as well. So thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's been It's been great.
Thank you for having us.
Great. Thanks, guys. And I also want to thank our producers, Jory Morales and Jack Inslee. And a special thanks to Polliner Imports because they both bring in these wines. And this has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.